Welcome to Brennan Abled with me, Gabriel Cohen.
And with me, Holly Osborne.
This is where we talk with brand leaders willing to share the real-world lessons from being in the trenches.
Their triumphs and setbacks in the messy business of building brands.
These are the human stories behind branding that you will never find in any brief or case study. Holly, I'm really excited about today's show. Keep me honest here, but would it be an exaggeration to say that when you sum up all of the traits and experiences that today's guest has, that they're a bit of a unicorn, at least a partial unicorn?
Yeah, I'd call Emily Miller a unicorn, or at least partial unicorn in training. The fact that she's been both client side and agency side, and in fact, I'll do you one better, on the same client. So she has literally been responsible for driving a client's brand from the agency side of things and then became the client. That's just such a rich pool to be able to kind of fish from. I'm excited to ask her a ton of nosy questions about what that was like. And she's also one of those people who I think is unicorn-like in that she entered this hardcore technology-driven company full of engineers, and she breathed brand life into it and was able slowly over time to convince people in the organization and show them how brand could deliver business value, even in the most hardcore tech environments where engineers kind of are king. Yeah, so I think she's pretty special.
Yeah, because she kind of comes from a similar world that you were in.
Oh, well, I wouldn't call myself a unicorn, though. But Emily and I lived through a lot of the same things, because when I was at Ciena, it was truly a culture focused on the technology, right? Your technology either puts you in a leadership position or you fall behind. And they did not see at first why or how brand would play a role in that. How could brand potentially or possibly contribute to convincing a client who's only looking at speeds and feeds? And without going into the detail, because today isn't about me, but about what Emily has accomplished, there are secrets that unlock, approaches that unlock that. I'll give you a spoiler alert. It requires patience. It requires diplomacy. It requires a lot of emotional intelligence and an ability to speak in a language that's different than what most stakeholders expect to hear from a brand person. You have to strip away all the language and learn a new one, or you won't communicate and be seen as a leader in that kind of environment. And Emily has cracked that. And I think she's going to be able to shed light on a challenge that so many of us face. You know, we want to apply the best brand principles in any scenario. And in some companies, it takes some time to lay the groundwork and prepare them to go on that journey. And I'm so excited to get into how Emily did that.
Yeah. So for those that don't know, NetApp is a data storage, data infrastructure company, truly global, that has been Fortune 500. It is has more than $6 billion annually. It's a massive company. If people have heard of Cisco, it's kind of in that space, maybe just not as well known. And Emily, I don't know anyone else who's been in a brand role who has worked for as many CMOs as she has. So that'll be a really interesting part of the conversation. So maybe you and I should stop talking and we should invite Emily in.
Let's do it.
Well, welcome, Emily Miller. It's wonderful to have you on.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Glad you're here, Emily. All right. Are you ready for us to get nosy? Bunch of questions. Well, okay. First, I want to back up because you actually, the last time that you and I worked together, I mean, we were kind of ships in the night at Landor, and I've got to set it up this way because this was the coolest thing, that you were managing a client within the agency and then got tapped by that client to go inside. And all of us were like, ooh, she's going over to the other side. Will we ever see her again? What happens over there?
Yeah.
And so it was kind of like this Freaky Friday, you know, sort of role switch, which was very cool. And you had already made a big impact on this brand as on the agency side at Landor. So walk us through, take us into that transition. So, okay, sure. You've now walked back in the doors and the people are familiar to you. The brand is familiar to you, but you now have a P&L. You're responsible. You're on the inside. We would love to just start there and just unpack what that was like, the transition. And did you have to completely change your thinking?
Sure. No, that's a great, great question, Holly. I think, you know, so I had started working with NetApp in, what was it, like March of 07, spent about 2.5 years with them as my client. Then the opportunity came to go in-house. And I think what I had always loved about NetApp as a client and what attracted me to come over as an employee was just the leadership. They were very transparent, very direct, very open with employees all the time. It was like going to an all hands for the first time. I hadn't been to like a company all hands like that since before the millennium, like when I worked for Symantec, you know, where we would have like company meetings. And it was, I was like, this is so bizarre. But what was great about the transition, as you say, was I knew the team, I knew the brand, because I had built the brand program on the agency side. But coming in, you know, at first, I still felt a bit like a consultant. And it kind of took that time to remember that I was going from consultant to, no, I actually need to like own and drive parts of like, you know, aspects of this program, or I need to find the partners who can help me drive this program, versus just kind of saying, you could do this. It's up to you. And so kind of going over, making that transition from, you know, consultant and guider of potential opportunities to, you got to own it and then drive it. And then it's up to you. Took a little bit of, you know, just took a little bit of time as you're kind of getting your sea legs, but, making that transition more to kind of being like, you're the owner. You're not just a observer. I think was one of the things that, and I think sometimes it's hard to make that transition if you've never been on the client side before. So luckily I'd been on the client side before being on the agency side. And then being able to then be the advocate for your client when you're working with new agencies, I think. And so how do you learn to kind of really be the advocate for the client now that you are the client, instead of kind of reverting back to like the agency, like observing the problem, which is wonderful when you're on the agency side. If you work with a nightmare client, you're like, I'm so glad I don't work there.
Right.
This was one where I was happy to work there. It was nice to join.
What was something that you observed within, let's say the first, I don't know, let's say 100 days, something that you saw that you thought, oh, I never would have seen this on agency side?
Oh, let's see. I think there's so many aspects of the business where people want your input. And I think that was actually something that was really gratifying, was because I knew a bunch of people in marketing, it was getting outside of marketing and getting, you know, working with people that were not maybe the traditional folks that I would have worked with when I was on the agency side. So being asked to come in and help with, I remember being asked to help with some naming for some programs, again, that were outside of marketing, but people just saying, you know, you are a resource, you have good suggestions. We want you to help out, even if, you know, again, it's not my skin in the game of their ultimate decision necessarily, but being able to help people think through things was really great to be asked to do.
I want to double click on that, because not everybody who joins such a tech forward and engineering driven company finds that marketing and brand is invited in so openly and so warmly, where they're saying, hey, good ideas, we need your help. Was that sort of that naturally was happening, or did you have to build that a little bit? And what was maybe one area of the business where that didn't happen naturally and you had to kind of make inroads?
I believe that, again, it's all how you, you know, tee yourself up. And I think because I had been the consultant, I was a little less threatening and I could come in and say, hey, here's a way to look at it. So being able to, and being able to be kind of a more of a professor is like how my former chief
professor Emily,
she would say, when you're coming in and doing this naming presentation, you're talking to a bunch of executives that don't do this every day. They may understand it and like conceptually, but they're very, again, being more engineering focused, they're not thinking about it in the way you are. So you have to kind of teach it to them like it's a course or like a TED talk where they're going to be kind of like, oh, okay, that's interesting. So taking that tact versus like, I'm the authority and I'm going to tell you what to do. Like, that's not going to fly. I think one area where like we had a big customer event and it used to be run as it's a customer event now, but back in the day, it was really more of a training event for the engineers and for folks on the technical side. And so it wasn't a marketing event, but they were having to do marketing. So they had sponsors, they had to put logos on notebooks. They had to put logo, you know, they had to have a sponsor of the big customer, you know, appreciation event and the music, and they didn't know how to do branding. And so they were just like putting logos on everything. And so I kind of came in and did a little bit of an audit and just said, you know, hey, there's like different ways we could think about this. And let's think about this like holistically. And, you know, you don't actually have to give this away. And it actually looks like it's their event instead of your event. Like, how do we think about this? And so, again, just being more slightly academic, I would say, in the approach and showing ways in which it could work without mandating or instructing. I remember my first day of work, the head of the public sector business met me and he's like, oh, you're the new brand police. And I was like, no, that is not, I hate that.
Here we go.
Yeah. And so I was like, so kind of the goal, like I had a metric for my team. One of the first years I was there and it was like, how many times are we referred to as the brand police versus the brand team? And if the brand police mentions are going down, then we're doing the right thing. And thankfully, I don't think anybody thinks of me as a police captain, so that's good.
And how did you do?
We did pretty well. I mean, I think we gained a lot of fans again by, you know, it's the, you know, how this is how it could work if you would like to go this way, not being, you know, not being militant, because I do think people resist the militants, especially like very entrepreneurial minded folks. Don't like being told what to do. But I will say everybody was always very curious to do the right thing. And so if you could show them the right thing and not scold them, then they were like, oh, okay, I get it. And then they would come back to you the next time before they completed the project. And they would say, do you have any input that you could give me before I go too far down the path? And then, so that's kind of how you then build that credibility, build that trust that you are not the scary person who's going to shut their project down, but actually get their input ahead of time so then it's successful for everybody.
Did you have to do some coaching with your internal team on how to respond on changing some of the mentality?
Yes, I definitely did work a lot with the team again, and I do credit my upbringing from a mother who was Southern, where she always said, you know, you catch more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. And so again, you can't come in and like just start smacking people down. But if you come in and say, hey, you know, I'd like to work with you on this and your team, the reason why is because this XYZ, again, if you explain to people why, like hard things are easier to accept, be it a layoff, be it you bastardize the logo, you know, those are easier to get through and get through to a better solution if you can explain why. And again, a lot of people, they've never been told why, because they'd never been exposed to this kind of thinking. And because it wasn't a discipline that had been staffed up, you know, significantly. So getting your team to understand that, like, it's about building relationships, it's about building, earning the trust, and then you can start to coach and educate, kind of influence without them knowing. And then it's
amazing because I'm from the South and I never heard that expression growing up. So maybe it was a different part of the South.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Emily, would it be fair to say that your first chapter, let's call it, at NetApp, would be, if we had to title the chapter, it would be educator, you know, at the education era. And did you continue to have to lean into the role as an educator or sort of Professor Emily as you continued on in your tenure? Or how would you sort of label the net? Like, was there another, the next chapter where it was more about Igniter? Or, you know, sort of how would you label your evolution over your time there?
Yeah. And I would say that like, I think, cause it's been 15 years now that I've worked there. Woo-hoo. And I look back to like those first days and I do remember that feeling of kind of like tentativeness of, okay, I'm coming in from the outside and, you know, coming in with this, like this, you know, with this title and this role, this is the first time they'd had a full-time brand director role. I feel like once I became more comfortable and could feel the positive response to, hey, I'm here to help you, I'm not here to just smack you down, then that gave me, I would say, the confidence and the platform to have a stronger voice, to be able to push more strategic leadership brand considerations, I would say, versus let's get the basics of brand management right. Because again, I think you can't, you know, we had a great chief strategy officer, Holly and I did at Landor, who would say, you know, when the student is ready, the lesson appears.
Love
like
that.
You can't start calculus when you haven't conquered algebra. So you've got to do those baby steps. Mm-hmm. So once we kind of had the basics of brand management in place, we had the team in place, people knew they could come to our team and they may not get the answer they wanted, but they would get help to get to the right solution. And then they might actually go, oh, I didn't even know that was possible. Or now I understand why it's this and not when I came to you originally. So once that kind of trust had been earned, then it did move into more of like, you know, flag bearer to say, these are things we need to do. And I think, you know, we've had a lot of executive turnover. I think I shared with you, I've had, you know, probably about 7, 8, 9 CMOs, you know, all coming in with their different areas of focus and mandates, but it's a continuing education process, I would say, with our executives, because as we grow as a company, as we become more mature, as we've done acquisitions, as our, you know, the macro environment changes and the competitors change, we have shifted. You know, we 15 years ago, we were the upstart against EMC, then Pure was coming on our heels. Now Vast is on everybody's heels. So there's that dynamic is always shifting. Therefore, our brand challenges and considerations are always shifting.
That makes a ton of sense. And I'm curious, when you first got there, were you paired with a CMO who gave you the runway and the time to play that educator role? Or were you, help us understand what, because you saw what needed to be done in terms of building relationships, building trust, setting context, educating, mm-hmm. and that was going to end up gaining you, you know, much, much more productive relationships over time, right? Than you said, Slam. Did your CMO give you the chance to do that? Or was their expectation that you were going to come in and just, you know, kind of hit the ground running? How did you reconcile that?
So I think the first month I was there, the CMO moved into a new role and we were CMO-less for about four months.
Yeah. What was that like?
You know, okay, well, there's going to be a new sheriff in town. And so when that new CMO came on board, then it was, you know, she had a very clear sense of like, we, you know, need to develop a new narrative, a new positioning, new identity. And that's when I feel like I got into like a really great feeling of it's like in rowing, you call it the swing, you know, you're just like in a really good rhythm and everybody's really kind of working together. Because I was working with an agency that was more of an advertising agency and less of a branding agency. And so I felt like I basically had to kind of structure the program based on what I had learned at Landor, but was able to do that because I had gotten my sea legs at NetApp. So I'd been there almost a year and I was like, okay, this is what we're doing, people. and then, you know, so then was able to really drive that. And I think it was that ability to to drive, and then have that kind of confidence to do more than just kind of what I'd learned from Landor and take it further.
Emily, I think one of the things that truly is unique about your experience at NetApp is having worked with 8 or 9 different CMOs in the time that you've been there. What are some of the learnings that as you reflect back and having worked with so many different CMOs around, you can kind of separate them into these different segments, or how do you learn around how you need to adapt to understand their nuances when they come in so that you're adapting to them, not vice versa?
Right. It's definitely like a lesson or a crash course in learning how to manage up and learning what are their most important priorities and how can you get your priorities that you know are kind of the longer term. Because again, the CMOs come and go. And so as we stay, as a team, and like obviously new people are coming in and people are moving off, but because, being committed to wanting to drive and build the brand over time and see that, and grow and see the company succeed over time. It's, how can I take the things that I know we need to do and attach them to what's important to them so that, things on my agenda that maybe they're not thinking of, they become important because I attach them to their agenda. And also recognizing, what are every one of them brings different strengths. I've learned something from everyone. I think, when we were talking before, I shared, there's like a saying from each one that I've learned, the one who brought in integrated marketing, she had this mindset of think big, start small, move fast. And I have stolen that and used that many times. Another one used football analogies, American football analogies for everything. So it was, do not come to me at the 2-minute warning with the project and not having any exposure to it already, because then I can't help you. So we had this whole methodology around there's spring training where you're putting everything together and you're making the plan. And then there's kickoff and, then you've got, halftime. And so she's like, show me at kickoff so I can just say, yep, maybe tweak that. Then we come at halftime. And then when we get to the 2-minute warning, if there's any final touches we need to do, that's when you put the cherry on top of the sundae. Because if you come to me at the 2-minute warning and there's nothing, there's just no runway. So we ultimately have to punt. And so then we've kind of lost the opportunity.
Gabe, do you see the value of American football here? Are you getting, are you a believer now? I mean, this is some deep stuff.
Hey, Holly, I'm already a big American football convert. And I know my US sports to the extent that I can also recognize that Emily was mixing analogies there because spring training is baseball, not NFL. So I'm just going to drop that one there for a second.
No.
Preseason. Sorry. The draft. Yeah.
Oh, we're going to edit. We're going to edit that comment out, my friend.
So I've been to spring training the last 2 years. That's why I think it's on my mind.
That's so cool. Emily, that was fully approved by me. But what I'm dying to know about, okay, so the football analogy is so cool. I love a good sports analogy.
Yeah.
Go back to the think big, start small, act fast or move fast. Yeah. Can you give us an example, a real life example? How did you manifest that? Like, how did that show up in real work?
So I think it's so easy to think about these big, big things that have to get done. Like we call them big rocks. Like, yes, there are these major big rocks, but sometimes, as with anything in life, if it's just too, when it's too big and you're quote unquote boiling the ocean, it's impossible. So how do you look at something like super strategic, super important, big imperative that you do it, but break it down? And so like a lot of times I'll talk to my team and I'll say, let's pilot it, because anything called a pilot, you can get done. Like, just figure out how to size it. Let's pilot it and then see what works. And then we can tweak it. And then if it works well, then we can say, if you liked this, you can give us more money and we can do more of this. Because things just get so bogged down with timelines. And that's the move fast part is critical, because it is so hard to get things done quickly in a big company. Mm-hmm. I think that's really one of the hardest things. You're just in meetings all the time. And that's why we love good agencies, is because they're not in these meetings all the time. So the, and by sizing it and making it little digestible pilot, then you can move fast and you don't have to go through like so many, you know, again, like pick a country, pick a geo, pick a segment, just pick something, size it, get it done. And then it can, and then you can like build upon it. But gosh, getting something off the ground is hard.
When, what are the times that you purposely know, no, we have to treat this as a big rock? Cause that's the thing in branding, right? Sometimes that, that there are both sides to it. Sometimes if you're talking about like the big brand positioning or narrative, or yeah, it's architecture, or it's a more significant change to the visual expression, which happens less and less today because now it's more and more constant evolution. But how do you judge then the times when say, no, this time on this one, we need to do it as a big rock? Is that when it comes more, when you realize that there's that opportunity to top down, there's that executive engagement, or is it something
definitely
else?
Yeah. And I would say a good example of that is the most recent work we've done on our narrative, because we had a lot of acquisitions over the last 4 to 5 years. We had a lot of messaging around cloud that was needed, but it was also, you know, a little bit of a sense of over pivot. And I remember talking to an analyst and he's like, you're not alone. So it was obviously, you know, and cloud, you know, cloud was amazing during the pandemic. Like it was able to help a lot of customers do things that they maybe didn't know they were ready to do, but they had to do it immediately. So figuring out how to expand our narrative so that it could encompass the cloud acquisitions that we'd made versus having it be this either or that everybody was kind of pulling on these two poles. That was kind of like deep, like look deep into the company. It was a, that was a big rock that was full time. And that was involving the executive committee. They care about the identity, but that one is something that we can just kind of inform them more about. They don't need to pick unless you have an executive who really just wants to get involved beyond your marketing leadership. It just needs to be something that they don't dislike. And that's one that we could say like, this is our big rock and we're going to move on this. And then we're going to inform them on what needs to be done, you know, but again, that depends on personalities and interests.
So like much of tech, you've been at this, in this pivot point of moving from more of a kind of traditional like maker of boxes, mm-hmm, and software to this transition to the cloud. Can you give us kind of any insight, learnings around when you go and work on this type of narrative work in an organization that's global with so many different business units, so many stakeholders, getting that through, but once the work is done and making sure that then it can actually get used, yeah, and cascaded down through the parts of the organization so it doesn't just kind of live in this PowerPoint.
Totally. And I think sometimes it gets to the PowerPoint and then your sales team and your engineering team goes, I don't like it. And then it just stays and then nobody uses it. So then it kind of stays a marketing initiative. I think what worked, I think some of the differences this time for the narrative that we worked on was lots of deep involvement with our product leadership, so on our core business and our cloud leadership and their product marketing leaders. So really having them be a core part of that versus creating some things and giving them options. They needed to be so inherently involved. We also have a CMO right now who has a very strong product marketing background in addition to a corporate marketing background. And I think that's something where different CMOs maybe have brought different strengths, but those are two strengths that we need to make a brand narrative align with business strategy. And I think so that has made that successful, as well as then taking that and then really connecting it into the portfolio. We also got the portfolio narrative work done first, and then this connected down into something really strong versus connecting into just like, you know, hundreds of products that have no through line that brings them together. So that was where the partnership with product marketing was hugely, hugely important. And then we co-presented the content, because in the past it would be me saying, here's this new corporate narrative, here's a deck you should use for customers. And they were like, I don't want to use it. I don't think it's stupid. You know, I would never say that. But if we've, you know, created it with product marketing, I actually had my VP of product marketing on a call say, I used this with a customer this morning, and it sparked all these conversations, getting that kind of stamp of approval. And I, like, my joke on these brand road shows is like, I don't think I've ever created a deck on, you know, from like with a corporate marketing message that like sales has ever been happy to use. Because again, it's just, it involves so much involvement to get that buy-in. And because we put the time in to do it, granted, I also think we were at a unique time where sales was looking for the narrative too. Like they really felt strongly about like, we've got to add all this up to make it say something because what we have right now isn't working.
That's so interesting, Emily, because I think over the last 5 years, we've been talking a lot about how the agency client relationship has changed a lot and it needs to be a lot more co-creative. Mm-hmm. in working in the sausage making itself and having the client present the work internally, not always having the agency neither, but really having that sense of ownership. It's really interesting hearing you talk about that, because that when I hear that, I hear, oh, that co-creative exercise needs to happen a lot internally now, especially as brand starts to permeate through the organization, especially in most of us work where there's it's B2B or there's all these other departments and functions that really own the brand and own the brand story, that co-creation becomes more and more important. And I don't know how many brand leaders think about how much time they spend outside of their team.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I just had this, I don't know, like this thing come in my head that before the pandemic, we would always have the agency, like the agency meetings were always in person. Like we had an agency in London. We would fly to London for creative meetings. We, you know, obviously, and so it was just, there was a way of doing things that a lot of the ownership of selling in the story just sat with the agency because it literally sat with the agency. And then with the change in our working relationship with agencies during the pandemic and now coming out of it, like we've kept that flexibility and that need for kind of a bit more sharing of information. Because it couldn't just be in these moments of like drama in person. Like, it's like, no, we just need to kind of meet 3 or 4 times this week on Zoom and work on this and iterate.
Yeah, so getting rid of the big reveal, right? I'm like,
yeah. And I can't be big revealed to any more than my product marketing person. So it's brought us closer to the creative process and that strategic like development.
Yeah, that's healthy. I mean, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's that sort of conflating and that kind of blurring of lines is the way to go. I would love to grab on something that you said a minute ago that kind of sparked something, which you mentioned, and if I heard this correctly, you started with a portfolio narrative. Mm-hmm. And I did the exact same thing at Ciena. And I recall, had I gone for the jugular, had I gone up to the big corporate brand first, I think there would have been organ and tissue rejection. Like, right. I think it would have been, what is this program? Why? How are you grounding this? And who is this chick? Right. Like, where did you come from? and so the magic bullet was to start with something more tangible and bring brand into product, bring it into portfolio, build a story there. And then I could start to chip away at going higher and higher and higher upstream. Yeah. Was that sort of your secret sauce? And was that by design, or did you kind of luck into it, or how did you decide to start with portfolio narrative? What did that look like?
So, I mean, I would say that is, you know, that's a great outcome of the function of having a leader of product marketing at the time, who is now the CMO, who at the time, because she was a product marketing leader, but she also understood the importance of narrative and because of her experience in corporate marketing. So she knew that her task coming in was get a portfolio narrative. And then upon that, we needed to ultimately build it because we were trying to do the corporate narrative at the same time. Didn't work. It was just too much. Again, get like clean up the like, what do you need to do first? Kind of that think big, start small, move fast. Like, yes, the whole narrative needs to be fixed, but we can't fix the whole narrative until we get our, you know, building blocks in order, then we can move on to that.
In a way, that
people would have been like, what are you doing? This is impossible.
Totally. Cause it's like, you got to start with the what before you get to the why, which is, it sounds counterintuitive, in some way, because, you know, Simon Sinek and everybody's start with why. Not for every company though. Right. And if the company's product story, if the portfolio isn't hanging together, it is very challenging to then, you know, grow the brand from there because it's disparate, right? There isn't a purpose to what you're doing. And so now I'm curious about how money comes into it, right? Because anything that's touching portfolio, that's worth it, that can impact sales. When you started to go up the chain then and you were working on more the brand upstream, did you have the budgets you wanted? And how did you go fight for the resources that you needed?
So thankfully, because we'd had run rates for, you know, brand investment, mainly around like campaign, paid media. And we just, because we didn't have an organized message, it was like, let's not put that in market. So let's use the money we have to get, like, we got to get this clean up on aisle five and really get a strong narrative that we can then put out into the market. And so sometimes you do just need to kind of like chop some things off and just reallocate those funds to the right thing and get it together. And so that then you can go out with the right message. So
prioritize.
I want to go back to this portfolio narrative piece, because I think for too long, all of us who are practitioners, regardless of whether you're agency or client side, have thought about brand architecture too much from in terms of thinking about organizing principles, master brand, sub brands, almost like how we organize our logos. And the idea of portfolio narrative really forces us to have to elevate ourselves from a true business strategy standpoint in thinking about what's that story of how all of our products and businesses and hangs together, right? Or can you talk about, maybe for people that haven't thought about, oh, we haven't done portfolio narrative work, how should people be thinking about portfolio narrative? What is it? What is its value? How does it, is it a part of brand architecture? Is it part of something else? And what does a good, what is a good portfolio narrative?
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. I think where, like, it's funny, the NetApp engagement way back in the day was originally brand architecture. And then after the initial conversations, it was like, before you can do brand architecture, you need to have a story. Like, what is your narrative? I think where we've seen really great progress is that, you know, in the time that we took the break from, you know, kind of developing the narrative and took the campaign out of market, kind of hunkered down, developed the new story, working on the new, you know, the new message to the market. What we saw, not so much change, you know, we didn't see changes in our awareness, you know, because, like, no surprise, like, we weren't doing anything there. But what we did really see is a big shift in consideration. And so what I see that as is a proof point of having something to say to customers that are willing to consider us, willing to, you know, include us in the RFP, that it is more like you are talking about more than just the latest widget. And I think that is where the, especially B2B tech companies that are engineering led, it's, you focus on the, you know, the new launch coming out, the new box, the new widget, the new, you know, whatever. And you're constantly having to, like, change and update versus, like, what is the overall, you know, value or benefit that you're bringing to the customer? And then this change, you know, so trying to just kind of look at it from, like, yes, there's an efficiency standpoint, but it's also just the market's not going to be able to absorb all that. So what's the narrative that you can tell that can stay true over time that then just gets reinforced with these great product launches that come, you know, 3-4 times a year versus, like, every 3 or 4 months, you're, like, telling a new story. And so I think because we were able to center on a couple key messages at a higher level versus, like, message of the quarter, that has been able to, you know, we've seen a dramatic, you know, improvement on consideration because people feel like we are, you know, we have something of value for them.
But how distinct is what you just talked about from a corporate narrative to a portfolio
narrative? That was all the portfolio narrative, because we had not launched the corporate narrative yet. So I credit the portfolio narrative for kind of cleaning up. And again, we'd had a lot of acquisitions. People were like, why did you buy this company? What does this do versus that do? Why do these two things sound the same? You know,
is there anything about the process from developing a portfolio narrative that's different to the corporate narrative? So, for example, one of the things that we've seen is a notion of, well, when you go portfolio narrative, you kind of need a map customer needs or customer journey to our different product portfolio, so that they can see how our different products can map to aspects of their journey, or it's about trying to show how they hang together and then ladder up into a cohesive story. Is there anything else that you would change or add to that?
I mean, I would say that because the work on the portfolio was done, there was greater clarity on what are the key needs that we need to solve, so that when we came down from the corporate narrative, that it was like, that was how we figured out how they connected. And so that allowed us to do a little bit of rationalization, like kind of taking, like almost like portfolio narrative 2.0. Mm-hmm. That got a rev with the corporate narrative coming down, because then we were able to say, these actually are the ones that are, you know, maybe most important or most strategic, or like these new themes, trends, like AI, obviously. So bringing it in the middle. And I think that's where, to your point, Holly, of starting with the corporate narrative without having, you know, organization down below, you're dropping from way up high just into product, and you're missing that middle piece of value. And why should a customer care about, you know, about hearing more from you? You're not going to get it if you go from these lofty things that, and then just like, you know, go buy this box.
Yeah. You can't go from purpose to widget.
No.
Or from widget to purpose. Mm-hmm. And I'd be curious to know do you agree with this, Emily? And did you see a change in when you talked about pulling together through M&A and this portfolio starts to feel disorganized, or it appears disparate to mm-hmm. customers? When they're considering you, they want to know not just what the product does, but what investing in a relationship with you is going to give them. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, are you going to be there for me and have the right technology 18 months down the road, 36 months down the road? Did you find that portfolio narrative that wrapped up sort of the company's intention around product made it clearer to companies what you stood for? And what did that do for you in the RFP process? How did that show up? Like, when you're, take us through your guys and gals are responding to an RFP. They're describing product. How do you elevate that story in that circumstance?
Well, I think a good example would be, say, in an executive briefing. You know, you're preparing for that customer to come in. You understand what their biggest challenges are. And having the narrative provides your sales exec, your client exec, and your SEs that ability to frame up conversations and have more long-term strategic conversations with specialists that you bring on to those briefings. And it's in an organized, methodical, repeatable way versus, you know, these people out in the field having to like pull it together themselves every time. And that is not sustainable. It's not scalable. So by providing enough for people, they can then take it and then they can customize it to that account. Maybe they have special like interests, you know, they can add in, but and I think because we work so closely with sales and with product marketing and product leaders too, to get that deck fully integrated with the corporate narrative, they then see how like I can talk about this at a high level, and then it connects down into like our strategic areas that we're investing in for the future. And by the way, we just had a launch, you know, at our customer event last month, and it hangs together in a way that it didn't before. And that was something we did a roadshow this summer to Europe. And I had a sales leader who's been with the company like 12 years. And he was like, this is the first time, like, I really feel like we've told this story. And I was like, thank God.
What? It's so gratifying. And I think this, the secret sauce in there that I want to make sure we don't lose is your relationship with sales. Mm-hmm. That's often can be a rub there, right? That marketing creates something, you know, that it's right. But sales is saying, I can't, this isn't going to roll off my, this isn't natural. My customers are going to buy into this, please. Mm-hmm. And so you have what could have been a blended 1+1=3 relationship. It can become one of conflict. So was that by design that you brought sales along with you in that journey?
Yes, but I actually, but I used product marketing to hook them because.
Tell us more about that. Okay.
Things, you know, again, like when I, the other, you know, the other thing about, you know, first coming into the company and the brand police, like we actually intentionally just didn't use the word brand for probably the first 2 years that I worked there. We used reputation. We used, you know, enablement instead of brand guidelines, you know? So again, just trying to take like the fear out of the brand police role. And so if somebody else is able to bring something to someone who has like, so we did, when we did the narrative briefing, we did the recording, I had one of our CTOs who's just like a legend in the field. I had him do it with me instead of just me, because if it's just me, it's just the corporate marketing lady. If it's me plus him, it's endorsed. I mean, it's basically like, you know, it's brand partnerships. Like,
yeah, it's an endorsed
this guy's brand. I know this guy's brand is like highly relevant, highly, you know, attractive to everybody in the field. When he talks, they all listen. So I brought him onto my training and had him give half of it with me.
So smart.
So I think some of these learnings are very connected to that kind of Yoda-ish wisdom that you said at the start of the call, where at the start of the conversation on when the student is ready, the lesson appears. Can you give us a couple of other examples? Because under that, underneath that phrase is this notion, I think what we've really felt in getting to know you is this notion you have this blend of patience and persistence.
Yeah, and it's so funny because in my personal life, I am not known for being very patient.
We're all contradictions. We're all contradictions.
It is. I know we are. Yeah, it's all relative, right? It's all context. So I am a history major originally, and I love stories and talking. And so for me, it's all about, you know, how do you tell a story to somebody that they can relate to when you're telling them? So for me, it's all about, you know, I use analogies to try to get people to understand. So, you know, what is it? Why would we do a sponsorship with a brand? Did you see Can't Buy Me Love with Patrick Dempsey from like 1988, 89? You pay the popular girl to be your girlfriend for a month, you become popular. It's really that simple. The cost, the price is going to change, you know, property to property, but it's making it relatable. And I think a lot of times, so again, you kind of, sometimes you need to teach in an academic way when you're trying to, when you're bringing in, you know, a strategic conversation, but sometimes you need to do something that seems really like basic. Like, why do you not want to print the logo on every single napkin at a party? Well, because you don't need to. You don't need to brand every single thing to be on brand.
So what's the analogy for that one? What's the analogy for the napkins?
When you go to a wedding, if everything says Tony and Tina's wedding from the matches to the, it's just, oh, it's like less is more, people, you know? But again, if you don't know, you think you're doing the right thing by putting the logo, like you don't need the logo on every panel on a booth. But you do need to be able to walk around the booth and make sure that the logo is visible from every angle. But that doesn't mean you put the logo on every single panel. Like, not everything is a one-off thing. It's like, how do you look at everything like in concert? You know, it's that whole experience that you need to think about. So, and I think that's how brands become more sophisticated. And that was like, we just didn't have much of that knowledge in house. And so that's why I kind of felt like a teacher those first two years or so, because it was just meeting with all the different teams and saying, hey, have you thought about it this way? And then they'd go, oh, we never thought about that. I'm like, no problem. I'm not going to scold you or make you feel stupid. It's just, you know, I don't think about engineering, so I wouldn't presume to know what to tell them either. So
speaking of engineers, mm-hmm. we all know that we can convince people with emotion and that we're all humans, and there's a place for using emotion and storytelling in doesn't matter what brand you're working on.
Right.
But that's always often a challenge in tech companies and engineering, especially when the customers are engineer. Talk about how do you navigate that? How do you convince a company of engineers to imbue more emotion in storytelling? Or talk about some of the times when maybe, you know, you tried to do it and it didn't work, and what did you learn from it?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, you know, B2B tech is like, they care about brand, they just maybe don't know everything that needs to go into it. And so everything is really in service of, you know, demand and driving business. And that is what marketing and B2B, you can't forget that. If you forget that, then you're not going to be successful. So with the engineers, it's about math. You know, what is it that this is going to do? And how is that either quantifiable or measurable, or, you know, again, just, or how does it save, you know, how does it become more efficient by doing something? I think if you're able to kind of explain the math behind the decision, then you can get the attention. And then you can throw in the funny analogy about, you know, everything in branding is relatable to high school, because they get it, because they went to high school, you know. And I say, you know, did you ask that person out without even introducing yourself and showing them their name? No. So that's why you don't expect somebody to get a demand offer and like buy it right away. Like, they need to be warmed up.
Yeah. This ain't 16 candles, people.
No. Yeah.
It's more Can't Buy Me Love. Who knew that the 80s would give us, and John Hughes and all these guys would give us just like this wisdom for the
everything
ages.
Everything you need to know about branding, you could have learned in high school.
No kidding. So.
Emily, we're gonna wrap things up in a moment, so we'll just kind of finish with a couple of quick hits. Can you talk about having been there for so long, the importance of having a network and connections that you can continually learn from? Because the one truism is that corporate brand teams are small. So how do you share and learn from others in the role to ensure that you're staying current?
Yeah. So I'd say kind of two things jump to mind. One is, you know, who are my, you know, my internal touchstones that I can go to that maybe don't have the, you know, they may not have the subject matter expertise that I have, but they are a consumer of what I'm doing, especially, you know, being inside the company. That is hugely helpful to just kind of stay grounded and like what's working, what's not working. You know, how might I be able to do this differently? So, and people will reach out to me from all over the company with like, hey, I have an idea about this, and that's great. Like, I love getting their input and ideas and asking for feedback. The other is just maintaining my network of former colleagues. You know, I have many friends in marketing. And, you know, there's a lot of dog walking and conversation, you know, about like, I'm trying to deal with this. And so making sure that you have your professional, you know, it might bleed into your, you know, personal network, but it, like, you've got to build those networks of intelligence that you can tap into for different reasons. And so it might be, you know, based on, you know, the actual like subject matter, you know, organizational questions, you know, then also like, how are things working internally? And I, like, you need to be a connector and be connected.
Well, wonderful. The time has absolutely flown by. I think we could have kept going for another hour. Emily, it's been a wonderful conversation. Holly, anything else that we've missed before we wrap up?
Man, I mean, so many things. You know, I want to tap back into about 20 things that you've said, Em. So we may just well see you back here in this podcast again, but that was brilliant. Thank you. Really practical, applicable learnings today.
Great.
So
well, happy to join your podcast. Thanks so much for having me on.
We loved
Thank
it.
Thank you. And I'm going to go and watch some high school movies this weekend and try and pull those brand learnings.
I'm going to assign you Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, Gabe.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, that has to do with the networking and the community that Emily was just describing at the tail end there.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, because we offer offers so much value.
Don't know about the magic pants, but yeah. Friendship and yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
Emily,
beautiful.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Emily.
Okay.
It was great. Right. Great fun.
Thank you.
That is it for today's show. We started this podcast because we know that you are not alone in the challenges that you face. And the likelihood is that somebody somewhere has dealt with the same obstacles you're facing and might have even found a way to solve for it. For that reason, we've also created a community of brand leads who meet on a regular basis to share and learn from each other. So if you'd like to join that community or are interested in learning more, or if there is a brand challenge you'd like us to cover in one of our future episodes, please do get in touch with us. Gabriel@brandenabled.co. That's Gabriel@brandenabled.co. If you like today's episode, please share it with your colleagues and friends and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for joining us and see you next time.